the righteous mind.
Yes.
Righteous. What a not value free word.
Not at all.
Where do you want to start? Do you want to tell us a little bit about whose work we're talking about and the
sure.
perspective they're coming from?
Yep. Jonathan Haidt is a social psychologist. And he's studied morality frameworks, how we make the decisions that we did. So as a social psychologist, as opposed to a theologist? Theologian or a philosopher, his take on this is not figuring out what our morals should be, but how do we develop our morality? Mm. How do we operate in morality? What does it do for us? Why do people come at it in different ways?
Okay.
So it's not so much of what should be as what is.
And by morality, we're using the word morality here just basically as what we consider to be right and wrong.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
So I forget where I first came across his work, but I do know it really intrigued me when I started to hear about it. And I think in terms of particularly the polarization, I was really excited actually last week to hear our talk in community time about that very subject, the polarization of left and right and things like that, because I just was thinking this just kind of goes right into this in terms of why these differences are there and why they might be increasing. So in that regard, polarization, this is some of the research that I've come across. The top lines are about how people feel over these various administrations in the States, warmth towards their own party. The bottom line represents how people feel towards the other party. So if you're Democrat, how you feel about the top lines are about how Democrats feel about Democrats, how Republicans feel about Republicans. The bottom lines are how Democrats feel about Republicans, how Republicans feel about Democrats. And you can see whatever we imagine about has polarization increased? Yes, it has. Like, there's research to show this. And one of the things that Haidt's research brings about is we don't just disagree, we're not even just angry, we are disgusted with the other side. We see ourselves as having morals and the other side as evil, whatever that other side happens to be. In this case, a lot of his research is political. It asks people if they identify as liberals or conservatives, Democrats or Republicans, and then goes with those labels to see how those people differ. Haidt recounts an email from a conservative who sees the reasons people vote Democrat as laziness, and you despise people who work hard for their money, live their own lives, and don't rely on the government for help cradle to grave. But there's also, I think this was also from his work, from a Democrat. Republicans don't believe in imagination, partly because so few of them have one, but mostly because it gets in the way of their chosen work, which is to destroy the human race and the planet, whose goal in life is to profit from disaster, and who don't give a hoot about human beings. And this is pretty familiar to any of us who spend time on social media. We see not just assumptions about people's ideas, but their intent. And the moral frameworks that they walk out of. One of the illustrations that Haidt uses in his work is that of a rider and elephant. The elephant being our intuition and emotion, and the rider being the reason. And I quite deliberately chose a picture of an elephant with a bird on top, not a person, because I think that would give the exact opposite of the intent that Haidt is trying to create with this imagery, is that there is not a control of reason over our intuition and emotion. We tend to see ourselves as primarily rational creatures, and that do things according to whether or not they make sense. But, and I know this is something I was discussing recently with my son, who was telling me, well, people should just use their intelligence to make moral decisions. And I was trying to point out to him that through Socratic questioning that that might not always work out. Like, a lot of devil's advocate questions about smart people doing bad things, the two aren't being really related. But he really, I mean, he's 14. He couldn't get out of that idea that it has to be like intelligence will lead us to morality.
Well, it's a soothing idea.
It is.
Isn't it? I mean, if we could trust our intellect, mm-hmm. if we could kind of go, you know, I can trust this decision I'm making because I made it rationally.
Yeah.
I made it based on these reasons and this logic. So we I think one of the reasons we like that default position is because if we take that default position, we don't need to examine our own decisions and choices at the same level, mm-hmm. right? I look at this diagram, actually, and the first thing that came to mind was never go shopping when you're hungry.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's like a, such a basic idea, and it's a trope for us. We know the saying. But we also know the experience, right, of kind of if you got a list and you stick with the list, it kind of works better in terms of coming home with what's on the list.
Yeah.
But absolutely. As soon as we actually engage with our affective side, our intuition, our emotion, our how do I feel about this list? Did I have a list? Right? So it's just a very different experience. Mm-hmm. But it's soothing to think that my head's in charge at some level. Not for everybody, obviously, because for some people that's a horrible thought, and we're going to get to that, right? Or a horrible feeling. I don't actually want to operate that way.
And we can keep hearing this from academics as well, because so, like, if you think about the field of economics, so much of the theories that are proposed are based on the idea of humans as rational people who will do what makes the most sense for them.
Right.
And yet, it doesn't work out that way.
Can I just one further little rabbit trail here? So to represent the theologists.
Okay.
Theologists. For a moment.
Should be word.
That's right. It is now. that's the way it works, right? We're still, I think, struggling in many ways in Christian theology, certainly, with having just come past the zenith of the age where we privileged the rational in our conversations about the divine, right? It's like we can trust this teaching because it's logical.
Right.
And ignored...
the field of apologetics.
Yeah. We've ignored this diagram, this photograph, basically, in that work. And as there's an increasing body of research, intriguingly, kind of head first, but there's this body of research that says that's not actually the way we operate. Mm-hmm. That's made it hard to know how to think about how we operate.
Yeah. Back so to reason height. Has a role in all of this. It's not to lead the elephant. It is to find reasons that the elephant is doing what the elephant is doing. It comes along after to say, well, I want to do this, but I have good reasons for it. Hmm. But it doesn't lead. It follows. What we tend to do, if we want to believe something, we ask ourselves, can I believe this? And a single point in the favor is enough to convince us. But if we don't want to believe something, we ask ourselves, must I believe this? And a single point not in favor is enough to convince us. So we come at what we want to believe very differently, even in terms of the questions that we're willing to consider about it. Another concept that I really found intriguing from Height's research was the concept of weird people, weird being an acronym for Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. That's us, by the way.
Like as a community.
as a society.
Okay.
As North America.
I wasn't sure how narrow you were being. Don't include me, Judy.
Pretty much North America. You're weird, Tim. We know this. Yeah. Weird people are statistical outliers, but much research focuses in on them. If we really want to get frank, a lot of research that people do are the easiest people for academics to get a hold of is students in university. So they are really on the usually rich and educated end of things. But we are statistical outliers, and the rest of the world does not necessarily think the way we think, operate the way we operate. In particular, weird people are very individually focused. They tend to see individuals but not the relationships between those individuals, which is like a very key part of how societies operate.
Right. And we're surrounded by the fact that wealth is part of this picture and industrialization, which means technology is part of this picture. Mm-hmm. There's so many, we have so many tools at our disposal that allow us to operate individualistically and to sustain that in a way that makes it believable as a right way to live.
Yeah.
Right? We can actually kind of pull that off.
Oh,
except
yeah.
for the fact that we're like so depressed and so anyway.
And thus the key, like a key, right, that whole depression thing is it's our relationships that are the keys to our emotional health and sustainability.
Brief anecdote. I mean,
okay.
Some of my other work is with university students.
Yeah.
And I feel like I constantly have students in my office who are asking for advice. Well, that's lovely. Then we can actually have a connection. But they're asking for advice about things that when they actually articulate them, I find myself thinking, not saying on my good days, but thinking, how is that not obvious as a relational question? And then as the conversation continues, what I discover is that their relational experience is largely mediated by technology.
Could you give an example of a question that would fall under that?
Sure. Somebody becomes aware of a relational infidelity through their communication with a mutual friend online. So there's a triangle, right?
Yep.
There's three people in this story. But they know the other person, the person who's being ill-used in this, mm-hmm. doesn't know. So they know all of this through the digital realm. Do you tell the other person?
And what do you say?
There's so many factors. I say, tell me about this other... No, I don't.
No.
Actually,
yeah.
My first question is, what would you want them to do to you? I just find myself back at the most universal question, morally, that I'm aware of, which is do unto others, right?
Yeah.
And we start there. And then we have a conversation.
In my line of work, I have I work in an apartment building, and given the nature of it, how it is, like it's a very relational place because I run a mental health program within it, but we tend to get to know not just the clients in our program, but the whole building as a whole. And every once in a while, I will get a person coming to me with a concern about another family, wondering if there could be abuse or neglect going on. And they are very, very reluctant to do anything about it, even though it is a child that we're talking about, sometimes really young children.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just like, no, no, I talked to so-and-so, they said that, just keep to myself, it's none of my business. And it's like, we actually have laws in Manitoba that says if you know this, you have to report it.
Yeah, legally, this is your business.
Yeah, and it's not just a professional responsibility. It's a responsibility for any adult. But yeah, people are very reluctant to get out of the individual and address things that are happening in the community.
Messy.
Very.
Complicated.
Yeah.
Especially if we don't feel competent. Mm-hmm. And the only way we gain those competencies is by practice. And the idea of practicing relational competencies, which involves other people, that's just such a messy idea in an individualistic society, isn't it?
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Life is messy. Relationships are messy. You don't get away from that. So Haidt talks about the purpose of morality to be to bind and to blind. Meaning there are strong mind reasons that we form these systems of morality that we have, and we join with groups that feel similar to us. Because functioning in groups has helped humans tremendously. Haidt looks at this through an evolutionary framework. Mm-hmm. What has helped us to survive to the point that we are now? And having a common sense of morality binds us into groups, but it also blinds us that there might be a different way of thinking about things. So being convinced that our own worldview, while being convinced that our own worldview, hold on, I don't even know what I wrote here. One sec. Basically, evolutionarily, groups competing against each other, groups mean that the strongest survive. And those that have a strong group identity come ahead. And morality is a huge part of forming that strong group identity.
And we do it. I know Haidt says in his work that we do this now, even though we don't need to, right?
Yeah.
Like we don't need tribalism to survive. mm-hmm. which might be its evolutionary roots.
Yeah.
But we still do it. And mm-hmm. and at one level, we do it just because it's fun. Like, it feels good. And you use the illustration of sports.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And he said, basically, he says, sports is to tribalism what pornography is to sex. That's his illustration, right?
Okay.
It's a way of kind of exercising or experiencing an ancient biological evolutionary kind of drive, mm-hmm. but without actually engaging in the thing that gave us the drive in the first place.
Yeah.
Right? So just a very, it's an intriguing kind of comparison. And the photograph he uses, at least in the presentation that I saw, is, you know, a bunch of people at the Ohio State football game with O-H, I like the spelling of Ohio, painted on their naked chests, kind of like, right? Kind of this, you know, where's the other tribe? Well, they're on the other side of the stadium.
Yeah.
Right? So we're just doing this because it's in us to do it at some level.
Yeah, I saw this really work out this week because two of my coworkers are both hockey fans, but one for the Jets and one for St. Louis. So I came back one day and I found out that she had marked, the St. Louis person had marked in masking tape on the floor in their joint office, the Jet Zone and the St. Louis Zone. And then every time the Jets lost, she made his zone smaller.
I love it.
It was cool.
I love a peaceful workplace.
Yes, it's a fun place. So the six moral foundations that Haidt has focused on in his research. First one is care. So just related to our long evolution as mammals with attachment systems and the ability to feel or dislike the pain of others. So the virtues connected with that would be kindness, gentleness, nurturance. Another moral foundation is fairness, related to reciprocal altruism. This is about the ideas of justice, rights, autonomy. Loyalty would be related to that history of being tribal creatures and forming coalitions there. So values that come with that are patriotism, self-sacrifice for the group. And it's active anytime people feel that it's one for all for one. Fourth one would be authority. This foundation was shaped by our history of hierarchical social interactions. It interlies values of leadership and followership, including the deference to legitimate authority and respect for traditions. And then the fifth one is sanctity. The foundation was shaped by the psychology of disgust and contamination. So it underlies religious notions of striving to live in an elevated or less carnal and more noble way. The idea that the body is a temple that can be desecrated by immoral activities. And this is not restricted to religious reasoning either. And Haidt gives the example of the high value placed by, say, the more liberal and non-religious end of how do we eat? What do we put in our bodies? Is it organic? Is it good for us? Things like that.
Right. So historically, religious institutions have often made the expression of this, the embodied part of the expression of this, about our sexuality, right? This is where you mess this up. You do the wrong thing with your body, mm-hmm. so you violate this value that way. And he's saying, like, the new liberal, who is mm-hmm. irreligious categorically, mm-hmm. Is saying the way you violate your body is you just drink way too many sugary energy drinks.
Yep.
You're messing with the temple.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
So can you just review those just by name?
Yep.
So these are the values we care about in his, it uses these kind
There'll
of
one more.
Markers. Okay, sorry.
His original research focused on those fives, but later on he's always open to more candidates for what are our moral foundations. And recently they've started looking more on liberty, the feelings of reacting and resentment people feel if people dominate them or restrict their liberty. And, of course, this can often be in tension with the authority foundation. So it is care.
So these are things we care about,
yep.
morally speaking.
Yeah.
Okay.
Care, fairness, loyalty, authority, sanctity, and liberty. So Haidt has done a lot of research with a lot of different groups. And you can take this test online, by the way, to find out how do people prioritize these foundations in terms of how they make decisions. And this is the Canadian graph. Come on. Oh, went too far. How this works out can be seen over and over and over again, whether it's US, Canada, Europe. if you identify as more liberal, you tend to prioritize harm and fairness, and you don't quite put the same priorities on authority. In-group would be loyalty and purity, which is another word for sanctity. Whereas conservatives will tend to have balance between all five a little bit more.
I found this diagram offensive because it felt like it was authoritatively telling me something about my values.
Okay.
For instance.
Sounds good. Do you want to go into that some more?
No.
Carry on. Haidt has even found when he talks to liberals about loyalty, authority, and sanctity that they will actually reject these about as being about morality at all, but that they see them as immoral. Yet, I mean, if I think about how I see current stuff working out in political climates and things like that, I think I see evidence of even liberal people living out those principles. They just live them out in different ways than conservative. For example, if I think about the Evergreen State riots, which would be Evergreen State University, and when they there was a group of students that, oh, this is complex, they disagreed with something that a self-identified liberal professor was saying. And they rioted on the campus. They demanded his resignation or his firing, things like that. So when I think about that, I think while the students were emphasizing care and fairness, they did so in a way that showed other foundations. They were angry that the professor was not loyal to the cause. They seemed to see a certain sanctity in their cause, in that they felt it could not be questioned, and they took authority onto themselves, because they thought their views were true and right. So they wanted somebody to recognize their authority as the people who knew things.
Don't do it to me, but it's all right if I do it.
I'm not sure how they would see that in terms of authority or anything like that. Certainly, it the liberty comes into a strong. It's one of those things that is very hard for people to parse through right now.
Hmm.
Because this has happened again and again in various university campuses. In fact, just in the last few days, there's a group of students that have signed a petition to get Camille Paglia fired. And I mean, good luck with that, because she's a powerhouse.
Hmm. I guess I was just thinking, when I said that, Judy, partly I was just thinking that we all want to have agency.
Yes.
So if we think about authority in terms of agency, we all want to be able to exercise some authority in our lives. The feeling of belonging in group, right? Again, a feeling that most of us resonate with. Most of us don't do our best when we don't belong to or with anyone or anything, when we're just this isolated individual. And we have our own standards for what we regard as sacrosanct or pure.
Mm-hmm.
So if, as a liberal, I might say, don't tell me what those things are.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to be able to make my own choices about them.
Yes.
So I still value them. So I hold them as values. I don't want to espouse them as shared values.
Mm.
I want to have them as individual values.
Okay.
Is that
a
reasonable take on that?
Yeah.
Okay.
So from Haidt's view, all six have a role to play in our lives. In particular, the role of sanctity, especially as it plays out in religion, has been important to groups. Haidt does not come at this from a certain religious standpoint. Culturally, he's Jewish, but he identifies as atheist religiously. But he, in his research, he has found that religion does have a certain way of operating that has been important to groups throughout history. Because it's not the beliefs that are so important, but that people are enmeshed with their co-religionists. And this is what helps groups to function better. He talks about religious people acting differently. They give more to charity, including secular charities. They volunteer more of their time, including to secular organizations. And you can see how these kinds of values then help our society as a whole. And it seems to bind groups in a way that secular values don't. In this, he gave the example of apparently in the 19th century, there was groups of communes that were very commonplace, and they found that, and some of these communes were religious, some weren't. 6% of the secular ones survived 20 years, and 39% of the religious ones made it that amount of time. So in terms of binding people together successfully, religion has a strong track record for that. It's about when sacrifices, because if you are in a group, you have to make sacrifices for that group. If sacrifices are made sacred, then the result is cooperation without kinship. Because it's been easy for groups to fight for their families throughout history. And we see that evolutionarily. But when we want to have cooperation amongst people who have no relationship, no DNA relationship, it seems that religion binds those groups like nothing else can.
Well, and it's fascinating to me that in the history of religion, one of the language sets that's so powerful is the language that suggests a DNA connection, even though there isn't one.
Which language?
The family of God comes to mind.
Oh, okay, yes.
Right?
Brothers and sisters, exactly. The brethren.
Yeah. So that we use the language of family as part of binding a group often in religion and say, this is how you look at the world. Mm-hmm. And when we try to take that same language and say, what if the circle's bigger? Mm-hmm. Some people feel like, oh, that's really resonant. And other people feel like, no, it's not. Mm. You just took the thing that was sacred to me and said it's the same for everybody, which made it not sacred to anybody and blew on you, right?
Yeah.
So it's an interesting thing to examine and think about.
Kind of reminds me of that line from The Incredibles where the mom says, everybody's special, Dash. And he goes, well, that means nobody is.
Right. Yeah. And that's that whole inclination toward in-group.
Yeah.
Right? Kind of functioning.
Yeah.
What does in-group mean if everybody's the same?
Yep.
Yeah.
So Haidt would say that scientists misunderstand religion when they focus on individuals and beliefs rather than communities and practices. The utilitarian view of morality, where you just focus on the individual, it just doesn't tend to bring about social order. So that those things of loyalty, authority, and sanctity are needed to bring about the kind of society we need in order to achieve goals. So when we're in a moral matrix, we just do better. And when they dissolve, we tend to be less happy and more suicidal. A nation of individuals hungers for meaning. A nation of hives, bringing into mind the idea of bees as an analogy. A nation of hives is healthier and happier because our happiness doesn't come from within. It comes from right relationships between me and others, me and my work, and me and something larger than myself.
Hmm. Take one for the team.
Yeah.
As a sports metaphor, mm-hmm. right? So it's trying to, in every different realm, sort of trying to find a way to send this message that says, for example, that self-sacrifice is actually a high value mm-hmm. because of this greater good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't know about you, but I think that idea of self-sacrifice or looking at my role in it seems to be coming less. We seem to be being more able to point to something outside of ourselves as that is the problem, rather than to be able to look into ourselves, which I think where Jesus' idea of the log in our own eye really resonates.
I can't hear that parable referenced without seeing the Abbott and Costello sketch with the plank. In my imagination, right? It's like, what problem? Whap, you know. Yep.
So we hear a lot about social capital, the idea of our relationships help and how social ties bring trustworthiness and cooperation. And Haidt talks about the idea of moral capital. Let's see if I can, is it on? Okay. The idea that we have relationships between individuals, and those are really important to our functioning and to how we work together. But it operates in a framework, and the framework is our moral capital. It's created through structure and constraints. And the weird thing about this is that is what liberals often want to break down, is the structure and the constraints. Whereas conservatives are more likely to want to preserve these things that have actually provided that moral capital for us to live in. And by the way, I'm not coming at this as a person who's really conservative. I know it says a lot of good things about conservatives, but I consider myself to have moved to the left of center a long time ago. But I like Haidt's work in that it is, it's research-based, and I think it's good to look at ourselves and how this, how we may have lost something, how we may have thrown the baby out with the bathwater.
That's an interesting way to say that, Judy. I mean, you and I chatted about this earlier this week a little bit, and I've been reflecting on our conversation and just thinking how, when I look around this room and think about the stories that I know here, one of the things that comes to mind is that lots of the people in this room have had deeply formative experiences in the context of organized religion. And that for many of us, I mean, those experiences, like they would be in any other group context, might be a mixed bag, but there's lots in that bag that's really great. Like, there's lots of those experiences that have formed things in us that we cherish them, but we don't even know how much we cherish them until we find ourselves in a context where they don't exist, and then we're like, this is just awful. There's something essential missing here. And for many of us, our imagination about how that works is something that was formed primarily in a religious framework. Right? So then what happens when our own personal spirituality and our religious framework start having they're kind of on a collision course, or, you know, that something's unraveling. The story is it was handed to us isn't working anymore. Mm-hmm. Right? And we're like, oh, now what? Because all those things are fused together in our experience. Yeah. Right? And so we have to kind of step back far enough in that process to take the pieces apart and go, what are the pieces? Mm-hmm. And could they be assembled in a different way with that goodness still in them?
Yeah.
Right? So I know in this community, we often end up having this conversation sort of surface in a visible way when the people who take care of Kids Table, which is just like in the early going of how do these things get fused together, yeah, are going, how do we do this? Or when I talk with parents who are like, I don't know what I believe. How do I talk to my kid about what I believe when I don't have a clue what I believe right now? You know, so that's what's from Haidt's vantage point. That's partly what's going on here, mm-hmm, right? Is that we know by experience as adults that these good things were fused in this setting that came with a whole bunch of articulated strictures value-wise. And the strictures, so if we go in Haidt's language, if we move over to the liberal side of the conversation, we don't like those strictures anymore. Don't tell me about this version of authority. Don't tell me about this version of sanctity. I can figure it out, thanks very much, like morally speaking, right? Or in terms of the cultural rules for it. Don't tell me about this version of self-sacrifice. I'll figure it out. Like, don't get all vertical and authoritative on me here. Mm-hmm. Oh, wait a minute. I'll figure it out means I don't know what I believe. So what am I going to do? Yeah. And so we find ourselves in crisis, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the good news is we can move through that and deep into a next. We can evolve this. But along the way, we first of all have this experience of, uh-oh, a good thing went away. Yeah. And I'm floating around loose.
Yeah. No, yeah. I resonate with that a lot, both as a parent because of my own journey, but also being married to someone who deconverted to atheism and needing to figure out how to lead our kids through two parents who believe radically different things. Mm-hmm. But also as an individual, since I'm coming to the table, I mean, I was drawn here because of that idea of discongruence within certain things that I observed or read about, and that didn't really fit with where I grew up. But it's always been that, I think there's always been a tension for me being in this body about just, I don't want to lose what I know I had. Mm-hmm. Every time I go back to my hometown in Saskatchewan and I'm driving around on the gravel roads, I feel this sense of the heritage I grew up in, and it's strong, mm-hmm, and there's so many good things about it. So how do I still carry that forward while remaining in integrity, mm-hmm, to my new observations and things that come along?
Well said, Judy.
Thanks.
Yeah, I think that's a shared experience for lots of people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Haidt mentions Asian religions and the concept that we might see in the term yin-yang, that they tend to accept the idea of opposing forces and that they are both needed. Mm-hmm. And certainly even what I'm reading about, not Asians, but within the Jewish culture, and maybe this is why Haidt can do this so well, is debate is part of it all. And it's not debate necessarily for the point of finding out who is right, who wins, but just the process itself.
And as a brief side note, this is Jesus' tradition.
Yes.
This is the rabbinic tradition.
Yep.
And it's one of the reasons that story stays interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because Jesus isn't, and when Jesus talks, if we remember that, it helps us listen differently to the words of Jesus as we have them, right? That the mission, in terms of their historical context, their tradition, is not actually to say, here's the new thing that eradicates all the old things, and Jesus says that themselves. I'm not here to abolish the thing. Mm-hmm. Can we keep talking?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so that's actually the mission.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, but here in North America, we seem to be increasingly vilifying people who don't think like us, rather than seeing them as someone who is actually needed in us. We have a kind of, I don't even know how to pronounce that. I wrote it down and I read it. Manichaean. Do you know that word?
Oh, Manichaean.
Manichaean. Yeah, yeah. Thank you. This happens to me a lot. I read things. I don't know how they're pronounced.
We have that.
And then I go to talk about it, and then I embarrass myself because I have no idea how to say it. Thinking in terms of absolute good and absolute evil, and you don't make compromises with the devil. And this is where our whole idea of sanctity really is seen, in how, especially how we go online. But conservatives and liberals really both have something to bring to the table, as well as people all along the spectrum, in the center and things like that. We need people around us who disagree with us in order to sharpen our own thinking. More and more, we're trying to exclude people who don't think like us. Just this week, I was listening to a podcast by a self-identified conservative by the name of Arthur Brooks, and he said, I need to listen to progressives, largely because they are probably right about some things, and I don't know what they are yet.
That's not complicated. Anyway, let's keep going.
Well, isn't that true? Like, if I knew what they are, I would have already changed my viewpoint on that.
Assuming I could assimilate the rightness of them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And there's a certain idea that liberals may have actually even more growth to do than about this. 2,000 people were given this moral frameworks assignment where you saw the graph. But then they were asked how they think a typical liberal or conservative would answer the questions. In other words, if you were a liberal, you would be asked, how do you think a typical conservative would answer? If you were a conservative, how do you think a typical liberal would answer? And conservatives could accurately guess how liberals could answer, but the same was not true for liberals. Liberals were not accurate in guessing how conservatives would answer these questions.
That's because conservatives are irrelevant. What? I'm just playing the game as we've been talking about it. Who cares?
There's also the fear that we have to address, that our groupishness is good, but it could create something awful like fascism. But there's a difference between practices that create fascism, because that reinforces hierarchy, but community actually minimizes hierarchy. Fascism binds people to a leader, community binds people to each other. So out of all this, actually, I'm just going to take a moment to just ask any comments, questions, like right now.
When you talk about finding yourself moving a little more to the left of center, but that doesn't even talk about how maybe center has actually moved as well.
Mm. Ooh, good point.
So talk about the communal ideologies shifting, right becoming more right, left becoming more left or right, depending on how you look at it, and then center moving into truth.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a pretty dynamic context, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah.
Actually, I was also listening to some research on that kind of concept today, that as our environment changes, what we ascribe to certain terms change to provide that. They talked about the term violence, and we are actually in a much less violent society than we've ever been. But what we ascribe as violence is now starting to be speech, because it seems like we need to have this framework where the amount of violence is the same, so we need to put new things in the box of violence.
Can I make a suggestion here, Jude?
You bet.
And this is the clock talking.
Ah, yes.
I would love for us to be able to have a conversation as a community about some of this stuff, which was our intent, but no surprise, it's a big idea, and we started exploring, and we haven't done this. We haven't done part B, and I'm responsible, no small part.
That's fine.
Shall we do part two? We won't do it next week. We could take a week off and come back and do a bit of a recap and a summation and have a chance for a bit of a dialogue around this stuff.
Sure.
Would that be a good idea?
Sounds good.
Yeah? Anybody out there kind of feel like it'd be nice to keep exploring this a bit more? Okay.
Okay. Great.
Good. Can we leave it there for today then? Or is there some other thing we just want to say that sort of sews up this or sums in any
way? No, let's not sum it up. Okay. Let's just leave people thinking about it.
That'd be my inclination, too.
And there's actually a lot of TED Talks that Jonathan Haidt has done. So if you kind of want to explore this on your own a little bit without reading the full book, you got 20 minutes. You can do this.
Okay. Judy, thank you. Thank you for all the work you've done to bring some of these ideas to us. Absolutely. And a couple of weeks from now, we'll keep the party going.
Sounds good.
All right.